So before I start to read out the written questions, are there any questions from the floor or someone I would just like to ask? Well, let's see, you have a choice, you see.
So I grew up in two different worlds.
Yeah.
One teaches me moderation, middle path, non-attachment. And one teaches me to stay hungry, stay foolish, be obsessed with your goals, and try your best. Both requires mindfulness. One is to know my limits, let go. And one is to exceed my limits in order to perform. So how does one reconcile such a difference?
Well, I think you can't have it all in life, obviously. You have to make certain choices, and there comes a time when you have to decide which approach to life is more in accordance with your overall goals in life, what you want to do with your life. And ultimately, I think, fair to say that one defining factor of human beings is they don't want to suffer. They want to be happy. In whatever way, they understand those two concepts. So I would say, which is the approach that is consonant with your life goals. I don't agree. I have a different idea of what mindfulness means. The idea of being mindful and exceeding, that's not mindfulness to me. That's something else. So I think you have to be very careful about the words that you use when you talk about things, and you can legitimize something by using certain descriptive words which maybe not actually fit what you're doing. So the path of excess, it's not usually a path that is that sustainable until old age. You get burnt out very quickly. So if long life is not a goal for you, then the path of excess is probably a good one. If you want a short full life, you have no concerns about the effects on your physical health of a life of excess, that physical health is not a criteria for you, then that would sort of weigh it on the path of excess. The idea of always being hungry, what is the appeal of that?
The desire to become better at what you do. You still hungry for more performance, more determination, for more drive in order to make something happen according to what you want.
Yeah, and then when you make something happen, for what purpose?
For accomplishment, for self-confidence, for self-worth.
So self-worth is something that is dependent upon making something happen. Okay. And what kind of thing are we talking about?
Let's keep it casual and let's talk about sports.
Okay.
You play a dream team sports here. I have two mothers. One is in Thailand, and that's the one that teaches moderation.
Yeah.
Second mother is in New Zealand.
Mm.
She's a top athlete performer.
Mm.
So I play soccer in both countries. One tells me that we'll try our best. Let's see what the result is. There will let it be. In other parts of the world where I grew up, that's when you practice until exhaustion, and then you try to become better and things like that. Obviously, I both suffer. You still have to suffer properly from both sides, but at least maybe you suffer during the practice, or you suffer from the loss that you didn't try enough.
Yeah. Okay. Well. I think your kind of framework of presenting this kind of conflict is is not one that I would apply in this case. First of all, because the very idea of what does moderation mean? What is the middle path? And the middle path doesn't just mean like halfway between two extremes. And over a long term, the middle path can seem to someone outside of that particular way of life to be quite extreme. So monks, for instance, on the middle path, they, like this time of the year, they might, for instance, fast for a week or 2 weeks or not lay down for 3 months, but that would be considered as part of the middle path, like the big picture of the middle path. Secondly, if you read, let me just read you something. Just 1 minute, this is Thai language. Okay, let him find it. If you look at the Buddha's life, 6 years, he practiced asceticism to a level that had never been seen before in the world, because coming from a royal family and having lived a very pampered life, he had to prove to other people that when he eventually abandoned that, it wasn't because he wasn't up to it, but because he'd been right to the limits of it and gone beyond. The Buddha said that prior to his enlightenment, the one of the two main factors for his enlightenment was refusal to be content with the results that he'd already achieved. So in Buddhism, we're not at all denying or denigrating that desire to push boundaries and to go beyond and to do more than you think you can do. And in fact, in a tradition, in a forest tradition, northeast Thailand, that's exactly what teachers do. They push you to the very limits of endurance. So, you know, you're getting up at 2 or 3 in the morning, not getting to bed till 11 o'clock at night. Sometimes you're doing hard physical labor for 7-8 hours a day on one meal a day in extremely demanding physical conditions. So that kind of pushing that you're talking about in sports, and you're contrasting with the middle way, I don't see a contrast really. But the Buddha is, where the Buddha does, I think, make a very interesting point is in his analysis of motivation. And the Buddha says you can have a healthy motivation and unhealthy motivation. In Western academic circles now, they often talk about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So you have an extrinsic motivation, I mean, you're doing something for the glory and for the fame and for the social standing. Whereas if you're doing it with intrinsic motivation, because you see the intrinsic worth of that work, of that art, of that sport, and you want to do it to the very best you can do. And that's called chanda or dhamma chanda. Whereas the desire for some kind of external reward is what we call tanha, which is the cause of suffering. So this is one of the common misunderstandings and misrepresentations of Buddhism, that it's basically telling you don't desire anything, you know, just be kind of comfortable and don't. But the Buddha is saying that we need this kind of motivation in our life, but we tend to naturally, the unenlightened person will draw upon the tanha, the craving kind of motivation. And the goal is to shift the motivation to the intrinsic or the chanda style of motivation. So in brief, my understanding of path of Buddhist practice is not necessarily in contradiction with the kind of thing your mum in New Zealand is saying, you know, like be the best you can and push and push. That's quite familiar to me as a monk, that kind of concept. It's part of monk's life. But so there are some kind of superficial understandings of what middle way means and what the worldly way. So when you said excess, I'm thinking of a biomuk and all this kind of thing. But no, if you're talking about sports, then
or in any life's issues, or problems.
Sure.
Maybe I want to realize my potential, and I try and I fail, and I try and I fail, and I try and I fail, and maybe 50% I succeed and 50% I fail. Yeah. And how do I know when to let go? Do I keep pushing until it's the excess of any average human being should have to go through?
Well, I think you know for yourself. I mean, if you're doing something, for instance, which is causing long-term health problems, then you need to draw back a bit. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day about the problem in America now with, all over the world, with specialization in sports, where from quite a young age, if you're good at something, this is follow your dream, just do that sport and be really great in that sport. But you just do one sport and you're just using one set of muscles or one part of your body. And in long term, you're looking at quite serious health problems when you're in your 40s, maybe. Well, boxing and American football, obviously, with the kind of contact sports. But any even non-contact sports like tennis or golf, where you're using just one side of your body, that's kind of not so good for you in the long run. And sometimes you say, well, maybe I can be like good and really enjoy a lot of sports rather than being like number one at one particular sport. That's that's a kind of a trade-off that you might think about making. But if you are, if you are good at something and you really have a gift for it, and then why not? But in the end, before anything else, you're a human being, and whatever particular life goals you have and career goals or so and so, they're a subset of your whole life. And the problem is when they sort of take over and your whole sense of who you are becomes identified with one particular kind of skill you had. So I was counseling a sportsman some years ago, and he was an Olympic runner, and he contracted cancer. It was metastatic cancer, and he wasn't going to live for much longer. But so apart from dealing with the physical pain, it was just the mental pain of no longer being able to run. His whole identity, since he's like, since as long as he can remember, I'm the runner, I'm the best runner in my school, I'm the best runner in my college, I'm the best runner in my country, I run in the Olympics, And so you put all your eggs in one basket, and then suddenly you're separated from that and you're completely lost. So this is why I feel that having a spiritual dimension to life, where you can just stand back from all those kind of conventional identities, gives you that sense of balance. So what I'm saying is you have all this potential, but you also have the potential to be able to stand back from all that and to be able to develop that kind of judgment of, this is a bit too much now, and this is not enough, or this is what's needed. So it's developing that kind of ability, which can also be trained through constant practice.
At least you have a choice.
Yeah.
Whether to push or whether to withdraw if you like to.
Yeah, well, the Buddhist point is the more mindful you are, the more choices you have. The less mindful you are, then the more likely it is you're being manipulated by something, whether it's an ideal or a concept or people or society or expectations of others. But the more mindful you are, you're more aware of all this different stuff that's going on, and you have a choice whether or not to take it up or not. Yeah. Okay, so we've got this. Oh, Tamra Bahangsa. So this is the Buddha before his enlightenment. ที่กุลบุตรผู้บวชแล้วด้วยศรัทธาจะพึงปรารภการทำความเพียรด้วยการอธิษฐานจิตว่าแม้หนังเอ็นกระดูกเท่านั้นจักเหลืออยู่ เนื้อและเลือดในสรีระนี้จะเคือดแห้งไปก็ตามทีประโยชน์ใดอันบุคคลจะพึงรู้ถึงได้ด้วยกำลังด้วยความเพียรความปากปันของบุรุษถ้ายังไม่บรรลุประโยชน์นั้นแล้ว จักยุดความเพียรของบุรุษเสียเป็นไปเป็นไม่มีดังนี้โอเค so this is like ความตั้งใจของพระ Okay, so this first question is actually in Thai, but I'm going to translate it and answer in English. So there'll be a Thai session this afternoon. ถ้าคนเราไม่มีศาสนาจะเป็นอะไรไหมคะ So if we don't have a religion, does it matter? So I think this question is based upon certain premises that like imported from the West, and an idea of what a religion is and what it means to be religious or to have a religion. To my point of view, Buddhism is a very anomalous religion. It doesn't fit in the same categories as Christianity and Islam. And when all religions are sort of lumped together as this one thing called religion, then Buddhism comes out of it very badly because it's accepted to conform to ideas and standards which it doesn't aspire to. So, there's something I've been talking about for years now, but my basic characterization of the religions that grew up in the Middle East, particularly Christianity and Islam, is they are, before anything else, they are belief systems. They're a system of beliefs or dogmas which you have to take on before you can be considered as someone who is a member of that religion. Now, in Buddhism, that's not the case. Buddhism is not a belief system. As a Buddhist, you're not saying, okay, you're a Buddhist, you have to believe in this, 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 and this. And if you can believe it, then you're a true Buddhist. And if you're not, then you're a false Buddhist or you're a bad person or something. So I characterize Buddhism as essentially an education system. So it's a very different concept of what a religion is. And the difference between having a set of beliefs by which you guide your life, as things to refer to and give you your compass in life, things to conform to, and an education system, which is based upon the idea of fulfilling the human potential for enlightenment through a systematic training of conduct, emotion, thinking, wisdom. So I would say that essentially Buddhism answers the question, how can human beings be free of suffering and realize their highest potential, true happiness? Buddha's answer is through the practice of the Eightfold Path, through this education system. So when people in the West say, I don't have any religion, I'm not a religious person, then what do they mean by that? I think that mostly it means that people feel that they cannot use these dogmas as their guiding light in life. They don't believe, maybe they don't believe in the particular teachings, or they don't want any association with the religious organizations and structures. And they don't feel I don't need to believe in these things to lead the kind of life that I want to lead. This is my position when I was about 13, 14. So from the age of about 8 actually, but I didn't really articulate it so well at that age. But I found the teachings of Christianity unbelievable, I couldn't believe them. They didn't make sense to me, and I didn't see any reason why I should believe them. And I didn't see that people who believed them were any more admirable people than those who didn't believe in them. But I feel with Buddhism, we're talking about a system of education and human cultivation aimed at reducing and eliminating human suffering and maximizing the potential for happiness and inner freedom. So now I find more and more young Thais who particularly study in the West coming back and saying, oh yeah, I'm Mimi Sasanala. So, you know, it's kind of a cool thing these days to say that. You know, it's called Mimi Sasanala. Wow, so cool. But the question is, what do you mean by that? I mean, so I would say, okay, well, when you suffer, what do you do? When you get depressed, what's your strategy for dealing with depression? When you get stressed out, when you get anxious, when people treat you badly and you feel upset and angry, how do you deal with these things? And you have goals in your life, you know, and how do you develop the mental skills and mental qualities that you'll need to realize those goals? What's your strategy? What's your plan? And of course, nobody can answer this very satisfactorily. So I see this huge discrepancy, this huge gulf between the intelligence that people apply to their external, their studies, their careers, their business, and the kind of approach that they apply to their inner life. Some people can be very strategic. Well, yeah, I'm going to study this, and then I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I've got this kind of goal, and you've got it all worked out so logically. And then you say, well, what's your strategy for dealing with stress and tension and anger and greed and all these things that undermine your happiness in life? Blur, you know, nothing. This for me is just so remarkable that we could be so kind of thoughtful and intelligent as regards things like career and so completely unintelligent regarding things that really matter in your life, which is like your experience of happiness and suffering. So I would say that the Buddha is offering like a science, if you like. I call it an education system to overcome suffering and to realize enlightenment or the highest human potential. I'm saying, in a Buddhist sense, if you say, I'm not a Buddhist anymore. I'm not a sasana. What does that mean? Does that mean that you're comfortable with your present methodology, your strategy for dealing with suffering and happiness in your life? Or does it just mean that can't be bothered to go to the monastery, or you're not interested in putting food in monks' bowls or something like that, or you read in the newspaper about bad monks and then you just don't want to have anything to do with it? So I have those kinds of feelings about bad monks myself, that you find shocking and embarrassing and so on. But that's not the heart of Buddhism. Those are structures, and they say it's the outer husk of the religion. But the heart of the religion is not something that's affected by those kind of things and those kind of external behaviors. Going to a monastery or not or putting food in monks' bowls, that's not really what it's about. That they can be a beautiful part of what it's about, but it's not the essence of it. So if you say, if you're not having a belief system to live by, if that's what you understand, like sasana, religion, yeah, I don't think it's so important necessarily, but having some clearly defined path of inner development, I think is important, and that's what like Buddhism is about. And I, from my own studies, the Buddhist path is, in case I'm biased because I'm a monk, but it seemed to me by far the most profound and effective means of human development that's ever been developed, ever appeared in the world. What if we have anger or hatred towards someone who did to us previously or did something bad, I guess, and this feeling arises several times in daily life? How can we get rid of it? How can we release ourselves from anger and hatred? Well, with negative feelings that pop up in your mind, or any kind of thought, whether it's a greedy thought or an angry thought, you know, just suddenly just pops up. Maybe you see something or you hear something, it's a trigger. But it's not something that you decide you're going to feel at that moment. And so why does it arise? Well, because it's a conditioned phenomena, because you've thought in that way before, and you've identified with it and you've fed it, basically. So the more you feed something, the more it will come and find you. So the more you feed a dog or you feed a cat, then the more the dog and the cat will come expect to be fed. So mental states are like dogs and cats and animals. And the thing is, don't feed them. You have to kill the animal. But if you don't feed it, soon it'll go somewhere else. It won't come and bother you anymore. So when you have a angry thought towards somebody pop into your mind, you're just aware, well, there's that angry thought again. But you don't have to drive it out of your mind, and you don't have to sort of take it up and think about it. Yeah, it's just so awful when that person, how could that person treat me in that way after all the kind things I did for them in the past, and they completely betrayed me and this on. And then, so you can get into that, can't you? You can sit there for a long time and just go over and over, like what we call brungdang, you know, it's like this proliferation of this kind of negative emotion. And so that's something that you do to yourself. That's not something anybody's doing to you. You make a choice to take up that thought and to carry it on and make something more out of it. And the more you feed it, the stronger it becomes, the more likely it is to pop up in your mind, and the more likely it is you'll to follow it and make something out of it. So just now we were talking about the middle way, and this is also one way of looking at the middle way, is the, you have these two choices, and well, you have three choices really. One choice is when something that you don't like and is threatening or upsetting arises in your mind, one, you try and drive it away, and secondly, or repress it, suppress it. The other is to indulge in it, and those are both extremes. So the middle way is simply to acknowledge it with an even mind, just to recognize it as a mental state and allow it to pass away by itself, because it doesn't last, you know. And if you don't feed it, it'll gradually fade away. But one important point to recognize is that if you try to get rid of something from your mind, that feeds it in the same way as if you welcome it into your mind. So we have this very good phrase in Thai, is it? Samkhan man mai man. You know, you samkhan man. You give importance to something. So when you try to drive it away, you're actually giving it importance. You're saying it's so important that you can't have it in your mind even for a moment. So that's giving it a reality that it doesn't really have. So the middle way is not to react, simply to be mindful and recognize and allow it to pass away, and gradually it will fade away. But that particular thought or emotion is just one instance of this whole area of aversion, hatred, anger, aversion, so on. So how do you deal with that altogether? Well, just now I spoke about the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is often summarized or telescoped into three areas of cultivation or development. One is conduct, one is the area of the heart or of emotions, and one is of thinking and wisdom. So any effective strategy to deal with a negative emotion has to deal with it in those three areas simultaneously. So in the area of conduct, then our tool for cultivation in the area of conduct is our ability to refrain from actions that we see as being harmful or inappropriate in some way. And I was talking about this in the talk last night. So we can say, yeah, I do want this. You know, I really want to shout and give that person a piece of my mind, or even to hit them, but I won't. Okay, so by maintaining that standard, then you prevent that negative emotion of anger, hatred, from entering the world outside of you. You know, now it's no longer your business alone. It's impacting on your relationships, the people around you. And there will be some comeback. There will be some consequences from that. And it's through acting on anger, particularly, that you can create very bad karma, which will cause suffering for yourself and others, both short-term and long-term, including future lives. So refraining from acting upon angry impulses protects you from very bad karma. But it's not the end of the story. So in the realm of the mind and the heart, we need to cultivate virtues which directly counteract, directly oppose that negativity. And the most important is mindfulness. Mindfulness means being present to what's going on in terms of whether what's going on is wholesome or unwholesome, is healthy, unhealthy. It's not just being in the present moment, but there's a sense of, there's a value judgment there also. So in the case of mindfulness, when it's well established, we our observation of what's going on inside of us becomes much more subtle. And we can see that before any real anger arises in the mind, there are some initiatives, certain patterns that we can observe. And we tend to fall into this kind of rut or this pattern. And a pattern often is characterized by certain specific physical sensations. And they'll vary from person to person, whether in the head area, in the chest, in the arms. But if you can recognize that physical pattern of tension, that's your warning signal that you're starting to fall into that path leading to anger. And so if your mindfulness is very sharp, you can cut it off when it's still very weak, through that sensitivity to these physical, mental changes going on in your mind, which you know are the pattern that leads to anger and hatred. Reflecting on loving kindness, developing a practice of loving kindness, and developing positive emotion in a very systematic way, obviously reduces the power of the negative emotion. Thirdly, patience. Just being able to bear with unpleasant feelings that arise without lashing out and being very reactive and impulsive, simply because you don't get what you want, or you have something that you don't want. So patience gives you the space in which you can see things more clearly, and to prevent anger from taking hold of your mind. But still, even with this work on the in the area of your conduct and your heart, the root cause of anger is in your thinking and your attitudes to life. And this is where the most important work is done. So you start to analyze, for instance, well, why does that make me angry? I say, oh, that person, when she does this, it makes me so angry. So first of all, you're assuming that someone can make you angry. And is that the case? Can someone make you angry? They can act in certain ways which you choose to be angry. You don't have to be angry, because there are other people who, if they're spoken to in that way or treated in that way, they don't get angry necessarily, or maybe not so much as we do. And you can see also in yourself that the amount of anger in your mind is going to be conditioned by other things going on in your life. If you're a very stressed out and anxious and tired, and you have some, you meet something, you have some experience which is unpleasant, it's much more likely that there'll be strong anger than there is if you're feeling very relaxed and happy and content with life. So it's a complex conditioned phenomena. But what we can observe is that when we want something and we don't get what we want, then anger is likely to result. So, you know, for people, like you say, in gang cultures, let's say, people in big cities in gang cultures, young men who have very little wealth and standing in society. So for them, what they want is respect, to be respected. So the worst thing you can do in that kind of environment is to show disrespect for someone. You can get killed for disrespecting somebody. Because that's the one thing that they that their self-respect and self-esteem is based upon, being respected in the terms that they, you know, they establish for themselves. If you want somebody to be a certain way, or you want a certain person to say something and they don't say what you want them to say, they don't do what you want them to do, or they're not the kind of people that you want them to be, you know, then this can be make us angry, or feel like they make us angry. But it's, I think, really important to understand that nobody can make you angry. At the end of the day, no matter what the provocation might be, whether you get angry or not, it's up to you. And if you can develop, you can cultivate your mind well enough, you can endure anything without getting angry. So the next question might be, well, is that a good thing? And people say, well, you need anger. And you hear this a lot in the West, you know, like righteous anger. You've got to get angry with evil people. Otherwise, where will you find the energy to be able to overthrow evil in the world? Energy is what gives you your anger, is what gives you your energy. So from Buddhist point of view is, yeah, it's a kind of energy, but it's not a good energy. And ultimately, it's not, doesn't have good results, because you end up dropping to the same level as the people that you're fighting against, and that it's very difficult to contain anger once you give it some kind of legitimacy. You say it's all right to be angry in this situation. You can't just keep it in a box. You know, it breaks out of the box and enters into other areas. And you know, there's nothing worse than people who are self-righteously angry. You know, the people willing to do the most terrible things. You know, this, like in religious wars and civil wars, where the most terrible atrocities occur, is when people commit atrocities because they think they're right. And once people think they're right, then they lose all kind of sense of proportion and can do anything, basically. So it's a training, an education of conduct, of emotion, of thinking. It depends upon observation and learning from experience. Okay, before I answer next question, is there any kind of response to that? Anybody wants to make any comment or to ask anything? Sot. Please feel free if you would like. You don't have to agree with me also. If you don't agree, you can say, Ajahn, you got it wrong. It's not like that. Okay, I'll carry on. If my dog is suffering from late stage cancer, should I put it to sleep to end its suffering? I have a couple of comments on the question. The first sentence, if my dog is suffering. So who decided that dog belongs to you? It's your idea. I mean, does the dog think it belongs to you? I mean, we have this idea that we can possess animals. I mean, is that really true? I mean, it's just an idea we have, you know? Once you say it's my dog, it means like, I have the power. I have the right. I have the right to decide whether it's going to live or whether it's going to die. But, do you really have that right? Who are you to say, dog's cancer, or kill it? And we say, we don't say kill it, we say put it to sleep. That sounds nicer than kill it, but that's what it really is. Taking life, whatever the motivation might be, whether it's a really gross and awful motivation like killing for pleasure and killing to inflict maximum pain, that would obviously be very heavy karma committed. But if you take life even out of compassion for the suffering of another being, it's still taking life. It's still heavy karma involved. And as I say, who says you have the right to do that anyway? So I understand it's terrible to see anybody suffer and animals. I don't know about you. If you see a dog limping, or walking on like three legs, somehow it's like more sad than a human limping. There's just something about it that's very poignant. But the suffering of creatures, you can say, is the karma of that creature. I mean, the whole idea of mercy killing and putting to death, is based upon refusal to consider the fact that death isn't the end of something. There is rebirth after this. So my suggestion would be to help to alleviate pain in whatever way you can. And there are plenty of strong pain-killing drugs these days. But that taking the life of an animal is quite a big step, and you really need to think it through very carefully. So it may be if you meditate a bit, just make your mind very calm, just stand back from your emotions a little bit, and weigh up the options. And if you decide that, yeah, I'm going to go for it and take him to the vet and have the vet give him an injection, then that's your choice. You know? And as I say, given that it's done with kindness and compassion, then the karma is much less than if you were to kill for sport or kill for pleasure. But it is still taking a life. Yeah. The other thing, of course, and this is not only the case with animals, but is how much of our feeling is compassion, and how much is it our discomfort at being in the presence of severe pain. So you find that people who have very little physical endurance and have a great deal of fear of physical pain themselves are often the people most enthusiastic for things like euthanasia and mercy killing of any kind. So there's a certain amount of kind of fear and personal discomfort and not wanting to have to feel like this that can also come into play, which you have to be very honest about as well. Oh, I need that one. So this is a kind of related question. If I were about to die and I became disabled, how would I stop myself from misery and worries before death? Yeah, well, this is one of the good reasons for meditating and practicing the Dhamma from when you're still young. One, creating a good karma and barami, but also developing the ability to look after your mind and to be able to deal with discomfort and pain and fear and anxiety. So this is the kind of life skills that you're learning in the Buddha's path. And so that when you do have some serious problem in life, and you know, it might not be right at the end of the life, but before that, you can maybe lose a loved one, be involved in a divorce, lose your job, all these kinds of things, you know, where you have a serious problem just arise out of the blue. Then that's when you're going to need this kind of life skills that I've been talking about. It's not something you can just apply like a plaster or a first aid kit. It's something that has to be really embedded in the whole way you live your life and the whole way you you look at life. So that as you get old, you know, I'm of the nature to age. I've not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sicken, not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. I'm going to be separated from everything and everyone I love. This is like a daily chant, daily reflection for Buddhists. So you're practicing with it. You're rehearsing it right from when you're still young and healthy, so that when that really does happen, it's no big deal. Yeah, I'm 60, you know, I've been reflecting on old age, sickness and death over 40 years now. Reflecting on it every day, thinking about it every day. And it's not depressing to think about it, quite the opposite. But it means when you get older, like kind of the anxieties and fears, worries about sickness and death, Their basis, you know, has been so dealt with over such a long period of time. It's very different from the way someone who'd never applied their mind in this way would think and feel. So, as I say, it's not a matter of, when you get to that point, if you suddenly find you've got last stage cancer and you're paralyzed or something, this is the Buddhist technique to deal with that. You know, it's like a magic bullet. You know, it's not like that. It's a matter of developing these skills and abilities throughout your life where you have a certain maturity, which will give you that confidence that when that thing should happen, I'll be ready for it. So how can we deal with people who are aggressive, difficult, and mean? Well, first of all, first question is, are they deliberately aggressive, difficult, and mean? Because some people are just so lacking in self-awareness. They can be very smart people, but they just have this kind of style that they've developed that nobody's ever taken them up on. And I've met people like this and say, do you know people really find you very aggressive, difficult, and mean? What? Me? Really? You know? And the funny thing is that, you know, people like this can often be very, very sharp observant about other people. You know, they can say, you know, that guy, he's like this and like that. You say, yeah, well, that's so sharp. But then with themselves, can't see it at all. How could anybody look at me like that? You know, it's, oh, that's terrible. So, you know, this is one thing that people just develop these kind of styles of relating to other people. And it just becomes their kind of natural style, and they don't even realize sometimes. So don't necessarily assume that it's always the case that this is kind of being deliberately and targeting you in every case. Nevertheless, if what we do need to develop are good communication skills. So there are people who thrive on exerting power over others and intimidating people and using, sometimes like using their physical size, you know, like as a nation, you know, so sometimes you notice like Westerners are very big people, you know, they actually consciously using their size to intimidate you, using their anger to intimidate you. You know, often if someone's got a real strong temper or something, he said, oh, I can't be bothered to argue, it's just not worth it, it's just too stressful. You know, so some people know that, and they'll use that as a tool, isn't it? Yeah. If you get really angry and shout at people, mostly they just let you have your way. So, you know, that's your choice whether you're going to do that. But I think that it is important to be giving feedback right time and place in the right way to people who behave badly, out of compassion for them. It's a good deed to do, and maybe it will lead them to make some changes, maybe not. But I was referring to talking about this recently, that there's sometimes this idea in Thailand, like giving feedback is a kind of a Western thing, that we don't do that in Thailand. Our culture here is very different, and you know, we respect puyai and things like this. Well, fair enough, except that if we go back to the root, if you acknowledge that the root of Thai culture lies in Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, and go to the Vinaya, the Book of Discipline of the monks, the Code of Discipline, you find some very interesting things. And one of them is that concerns the duties of a student towards his teacher, or of a monk to his upachaya, praupachara. Of course, so there are the predictable ones, so, you know, like you wash their robes for them, you wash their feet for them, you do all these kind of services for your teacher. But less expected ones are, for instance, that if the teacher is behaving inappropriately, then the student has a duty to give him some feedback in a very polite, respectful way. And if you see your teacher behaving badly, not keeping the rules or something, and you don't say anything, then you're commit an offense. So you're in the wrong. So the idea of young monks, very junior people, giving feedback to seniors, including their teachers and upajayas, that's right there in the heart of Buddhist tradition. It's not a Western invention. And sometimes the way that words are translated can be misleading also. For instance, we have this Pali word that you may have heard is like subhajo, which is usually translated as wangai, songai. Okay. So when you hear that, you just assume this is a virtue for a student or for a young person. You know, it's like easy to teach, easy to tell off, easy to admonish. But the actual meaning of the word is more put ngai. Yeah, it's not wa ngai, it's put ngai. So that means you know, you have a senior person and you see something that they're doing, and it's, you know, they're very aggressive, they treat people rather meanly and unkindly and use their power in a rather unkind way. And you say, well, should I say anything or better just to keep quiet? And then somebody says, for instance, says, oh, maybe Laila Pudai, Tan Pudai, Pudai. You know, so this is what Joe. So this is, you know, again, this is one of the virtues that we've lost. And we just allow that one to slip away. You know, this idea of when you're a Puyai, then you make it a point of being someone who's approachable, that younger people who have problems can feel that they can talk to you about it, that you can get feedback. Because if you're a boss or a leader in any way, then, you know, how difficult it is to develop as a human being if everyone around you is always saying yes, yeah, you know, you've got, or just yes men and yes women all the time, you know, and you've got people who are flattering you all the time, and people who keep bad news away from you all the time. So it's a really important virtue to develop as a leader, where people see you genuinely interested in making this the best possible company or the best possible monastery, and that includes making changes to one's own behavior, if that's part of it. So, you know, I think this is a really weak area that needs a lot of work in almost every organization that I'm familiar with, at least in Thailand, and creating communities and cultures in which there is a better exchange of information. So with someone who's aggressive, difficult, and mean, then, you know, the question is, well, is it someone senior to you? Is it a colleague? Hopefully it's not someone who's junior to you. But obviously if it's someone who's on the same level as you, then finding the right time and place and just saying, look, do you realize, you know, when the thing about giving feedback, one of the most important things to remember is feedback must be specific. Must be very specific. And for instance, never talk about someone's character or personality, saying, you know, you're such a this kind of person, you know, you're always doing this. Whenever you always say this, you always undermine me in public, you know, you always take the other person's side when there's a conflict. You know, that kind of, when you, especially with a partner, husband, wife, partner, you know, this is something that comes up a lot, you know, you're always, you're never. So is that really true? Always? Every single time? Or never, ever? No, not really. It's just like you just want to sort of put your point across. But for the other person, it's very hard to respond. If someone says to me, you're always so selfish, and what can you say? You just feel, no, that's unfair. You just want to reject that. You say, no, I'm not. And then you just kind of argue. And you're not always self. Yeah, if someone says to you, you know, when yesterday, you know, when I asked you to do this, and you said you couldn't be bothered, or you wanted to, you were playing a game, or you were on your phone and you didn't have time, you know, I felt really hurt. And if it seemed to me, you know, that you were putting just playing on your telephone as being more important than some family matter, for instance. Okay, so you know, this makes me feel like this very selfish behavior. But if you're very specific, so you're not saying you are a selfish person, but you're saying this yesterday or this morning. When you did this, when you said this, this is how I felt. So this is a way that there can be communication. When you're talking about things that were done, things that were said, and your own feelings. But when you start talking about general things, about you're this kind of person, or you're never here there for me, or you're this and you're that, then the communication breaks down. There's no possibility of going forward with that kind of conversation. So, if this, you say, okay, well, it's kind of a quiet time and the person seems in a good mood and you're in a good place, you say, look, sorry, I've got, something we talked about, you know, why are you so aggressive, difficult and mean? You know, and that person's not going to, be able to take that, I don't think. But if you say, you know, yesterday, when I asked you for that file, you said, what are you bothering me about? Like, you know, it just seemed so aggressive. It was really shocked me. They said, oh yeah, I remember. And a person say, oh, I'm sorry. You know, actually I was very stressed out about something else and didn't mean to, bark at you. And you say, well, yeah, you know, if you do have something on at home or you have some problem, you know, we appreciate if you don't take it out on me, you know, just be kind of just a like, gentle kind of feedback. And this is also part of Dhamma practice. This is like developing ability to live in society in a healthy way and to learn how to express our feelings and our views in the best possible way, in a way that people can listen and we can learn from each other. So most difficult conversations tend to be adversarial, you know. Who's going to win? You know, it's either you're going to win this conversation or I'm going to win it. But if you change the whole frame of conversation, make it learning conversation, you know, what can we learn from this? Then the whole thing changes very much. So yeah, I'm not sure whether this person will take on what you say, but if you, what I suggest is, if you can find a time to speak to that person and be very specific and don't make any kind of general statements or judgments about who they are and what kind of person they are, that it might work out. Okay, well, we're getting on for 12 o'clock, so any more questions we can? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Back to the long question. What if it was my life and I was paralyzed and I was about going to die? Would I be able to
It's not so straightforward as that, but it would be taking life. Yeah. How much did it cost? Where did you get it from?
I don't understand.
So it's your life. I mean, on what grounds is your life? I mean, do you have some kind of document proving it? I guess you've got a passport. But I mean, your life comes together because of your mother and your father, I think. It's not something you created yourself. But anyway, I think that, as I say, how things look from the outside and how they're actually experienced subjectively, not always the same thing. You know, when we see people in a lot of pain, you know, we imagine what it's like, but we don't actually know. So it could be very, very painful. But these days, we're in Thailand now, we're developing a hospice movement and developing structures that allow people to die in a dignified way with access to painkillers, but also with some spiritual support. So the thing is, how can you die in a way which is most in harmony with your values and your beliefs and to leave the world in a good way? I don't think that killing yourself is a good way. It's don't know the karmic results of that. I can't say this will be the result. Certainly, if you're in incredible pain and you felt you couldn't bear it anymore, I could sympathize with that, of course. But I don't think it's a wise way of dealing with, because it's not like the end of life is the end of your existence in samsara. You'll be reborn. And the act of killing yourself will have an effect on where you are reborn. So what that effect will be depend on many, many different factors. But it will certainly have one, it will have some effect. And I think that there's a lot to worry about with this modern euthanasia movement, because the question is, where do you draw the line? You know, so now we have, okay, if you're right at the end of your life, doctor says you're not going to live for more than a month or 2 months, you're in great physical pain. So people who have the money anyway, rich people, can go to Switzerland and have an injection and then end their life in a kind of nice way. But then it comes, now there's started to be people who say they've got first diagnosis of an illness. And then maybe they live for 5 years or 10 years, but why wait? You know, and you don't know what it's going to be like. You know, why? You know, it's just going to be downhill. Why not? You know, just cut it off right now in a nice way. Have a big party with all your friends and say goodbye. So once you have that idea, then when people say, well, you know, what about Kunyai? You know, Kunyai's got Alzheimer's. You know, she doesn't know anybody, even her daughters and family members come. She doesn't know anybody. She doesn't seem like she's very happy. Well, why not just put an end to it? Or someone's got this illness, or someone's got that illness, and you know the possibilities in the future. And now a big problem these days is like old people who feel I'm just a burden on my family. You know. They have to fight. They have to look after me. I go in it. It's like my mom is like, go anywhere. I have to go in a wheelchair and someone has to push me. And it's so much trouble for everyone. And I make all this problem for everyone and get very depressed. And then I can see within a few years, a lot of older people saying, well, yeah, I'm just such a burden on my family, financial burden on my family. And they all have to look after me. Make more sense just to go to Switzerland, probably do it in Sukhumvit by then. But then, it's also, apart from an individual choice, it's creating precedents and participating in something which is, I think, very worrying development in the world at the moment. It can have some very serious results. In terms of, you know, like, there's a book called Stumbling Towards Happiness. It's quite a few years old now, but there's an Ajahn in Harvard who wrote this book. And one of his points was how difficult it is for us to to project into the future. That we're not very good at doing projections. And we have a lot of very kind of irrational kind of things. So, for instance, if you were to ask somebody before lunch, like say right now, next week, I'm going to give you an invitation to go to a wonderful restaurant in somewhere or other, you know. And then you kind of grade, how excited about are you about that on a grade 1 to 10 or something. And then you ask the same person or somebody else just after lunch when they have a full stomach. And now from 8 to 10 or 9 to 10, they're down to about 5 to 10 because they're being affected by the fact that they feel full. And their ideas about the future have now been changed. They're conditioned by their present physical situation. So our ideas about how we would feel in the future are very unreliable. So he did this test on two groups of people. One group of people won the lottery, like first prize in a lottery, millions of dollars. And the other group were people who had car accidents or for some reason become paraplegic, completely paralyzed. And they asked for their like basic kind of level happiness levels. And the pattern is that most people have a certain kind of base level of contentment or happiness. And then something drastic happens. You win the lottery and it goes up like that. And then within 6 months, you're back down to your basic happiness level. So that maybe is more understandable with lottery winner. But it's the same with paraplegic. Someone who's like this, and then they become paralyzed, and they go down like this. And then after 6 months, they're more or less back to where they were before. So, yeah, it's incredible. So it's just this kind of a balancing system we have as human beings to come to terms with things in our life. So, you know, being paralyzed might not be such a terrible thing as it feels it would be now. Yeah, of course, nobody wants to be paralyzed. It's not a good thing. But it's not like the terrible, awful torment, you know, that you imagine it would be. Because you imagine what it would be like when you were first paralyzed, not like what it would be after some months. So my answer is not a good idea to go to Switzerland. Just invite monks round to chant and meditate and make your mind very wholesome and calm. And that's and then when the karma is expired and ready, you can leave the world in natural ways better. We have one more question before lunch. Okay, we can have an early lunch, 3 minutes. So you can arahang together.